Welcome to Professor Todd Landman's podcast series. In today's podcast, Todd talks about new research exploring how the way in which we ask questions about human rights affects the way we interpret events. The research focuses on the human rights abuse trial of General Rios Montt in Guatemala.
So the background is a very long conflict from the late 50s, early 1960s, all the way through the 1980s and 90s, where various rebel groups sought to challenge the incumbent regime. The incumbent regime in Guatemala was reliant in part, and in some ways very reliant, on support from the United States. The conflict in Guatemala was very much framed in terms of Cold War logic, where U.S. interests were very much aligned with not allowing another country to become communist. In fact, from Kennedy's, you know, alliance or progress in Latin America all the way through Ronald Reagan's approach in Central America and the Caribbean Basin Initiative was all around preventing any more Cubas. And that logic is important to understand the conflict in Guatemala because states like Guatemala had a lot of military assistance and a lot of advice, etc. And the militaries were trained to fight insurgency. Many of them trained in the United States and then took their training back into their own countries. So Rios Montt was a general who was in leading the country during a short period of time in the early 1980s. And under his period of rule, there was a very large spike in the number of people who were killed. The international community, as well as domestic NGOs and human rights activists in Guatemala, had always desired to put Rios Montt through some sort of judicial process. What's really interesting about the background is that the notion of universal jurisdiction, which allows international legal principles to be applied to anybody anywhere in the world, whether they've been a head of state or not, there have been advocacy campaigns for this since the 1920s, but it's not until the formation of the International Criminal Court, which took place through the Rome Statute in 1998, didn't come into force until 2002, and then we start seeing a number of cases from Africa being tried within the ICC, sort of that combination, alongside the Pinochet case in Britain, where here's a former head of state being detained by British police at the request of Spanish authorities through our extradition agreements with Spain. But the real judgment was, could a former head of state be held accountable for things that took place while he or she was in power? Now, the law lords on this case in the UK decided that Pinochet could be tried as a former head of state, but the political compromise was he wasn't healthy enough to stand trial and therefore was returned to his own country. And he actually died before any real judicial proceeding was able to be completed. But what's interesting is that signaled to the world that universal jurisdiction was real, that people could be tried. And of course, the Rios Montt movement to try Rios Montt gained a lot of credibility and a lot of strength from the Pinochet case. So there were attempts to use the Spanish court system again against Rios Montt, but ultimately a domestic trial was set up. And it's very interesting that we see here not Rios Montt being taken to the ICC or some other international tribunal, but being tried by a court within his own country.
And what was the research context? What was it that you wanted to look at and why?
What I was really interested in is that, first of all, this idea around how we talk about human rights and how one might be able to prosecute a case successfully. And I was influenced by an article I read by an academic named Richard Wilson at the University of Connecticut. Years ago, I'd been doing some research on truth commissions and truth and justice and transitional justice mechanisms around the world. And he made an observation based on the case of Guatemala that he had been in Guatemala at a football match, and there was a loud commotion. He heard some shots, and a local political figure had been killed. And so the facts of the case were, we have a body. We have bullets. We know that this person was shot and they are no longer living. So that we have, right? Now, he said there were different ways of talking about that. There was a kind of, you know, five or six different ways of framing that event. One was a political, one was a familial, one was local politics, you know. And depending on what frame you adopted, gave you a different interpretation of the event that actually happened. And he used that as a kind of an entry point to think about how we talk about human rights stories, because a lot of the transitional justice mechanisms rely on victims and survivors and families and friends coming forward and telling stories. And it is up to the Truth Commission or the people working on the case to make a determination as to whether that was a human rights violation. Now, in the case of this individual killed in Richard Wilson's story, it could have been that he was having an affair with one of the rivals in his village and he was taken out by the family. It could have been he was corrupt and someone decided to do away with him. Is it a human rights violation or is it just a simple crime, right? And so those are the sorts of determinations that are really important in doing human rights work. And it's up to legal definitions to figure whether the legal threshold has been met for making that determination. Now, that's a long-winded way of saying I was really interested in understanding how, if we talk about things differently, would that affect the way we interpret them as human rights events? So the Rios-Montt trial provided a perfect example to engage in experimental research around the framing of the trial and the framing of the idea of genocide. And that was a sort of inspiration behind the study.
So talk us through the experiment that you set up, what you did, and what you were looking to achieve.
The experiment was conducted at the University of Essex in its social science lab. This is a dedicated facility with 32 workstations where we can preload videos or any kind of stimulus. We can separate out respondents from one another so they can't see one another. There's no cross-contamination in the way they respond to questions. We have a respondent pool of about 1,500 people comprising local residents within the Colchester area as well as the international student body that we have. But the lab allows you to separate out those respondents. It lets you randomize questions. Everything's mounted on the system. And the respondents, there's no cross-contamination. It allows you to have control groups and treatment groups to tease out some of those different effects you're looking for.
So what did the experiment look like? What did you do with those respondents?
In the run-up to the trial in Guatemala, there was a film produced by PBS in the United States, the Public Broadcasting Service, on the types of evidence that would be used in the trial. And the film depicted forensic anthropologists uncovering mass graves, looking at indigenous people, communities, talking to people who had either been victims or at least had witnessed some of the atrocities that took place, as well as interviews with human rights activists and human rights statisticians about the types of evidence that would be advanced during the trial. And I thought this is a great, from experimental design point of view, stimulus for the respondents. So what we thought was we would show all respondents in our experiment the same video. So the video is about a 12 to 14 minute video that they watch. And then we asked them the same questions to everybody. We then said, well, how could we modify the experience that some of those respondents might have? So we created two treatment groups. Treatment group number one was given a sort of reasons of state argument, which was, here I was fighting an insurgency. You know, these were communist rebels overthrowing the state, wanting to overthrow the state. They had support from other international communists, and it was really down to us to save the state from this subversion, and therefore we had to do what we did. So we show the video, we then have that text that they read. This was a reasons of state problem, that's why we did what we did, and then we ask them the questions about genocide. Treatment group number two was given an international legal perspective. So they watch the video, they then get articles quoted from the Geneva Conventions with respect to what constitutes genocide, the intentional destruction of a particular type of people within a country or group of people. We then ask the questions about the trial and genocide. So we have a natural sort of experimental situation where we have over 150 respondents. They all watch the same video. The control group watches the video and we ask questions, do you think the court arrived at the right decision? And then they're finished. Treatment group one, they get the video, they then get the counterframe, we call it, which is, this is the reasons of state, we had to do what we do, and then they get asked the questions. And finally, the third group, they watch the video, they get the international legal discourse around genocide, and ask the same set of questions. So it's a perfect experimental design to see if there are what we call framing effects.
Let's get into the nitty-gritty of some of the findings then. On the question about genocide, what did the respondents say and how did that differ across the different groups?
So the question we asked was, did the army commit genocide? It was a bit a longer question, but it was really around, was the Guatemalan army responsible for genocide? Now, what's interesting is the responses we allowed were definitely yes, probably yes, maybe, probably no, definitely no, or don't know. And the grouping of response was very much towards the definitely yes and probably yes. So in the control group, there were 43% of the respondents said definitely yes and 52% said probably yes. But what's interesting is when you go to the counterframe group, that group of definitely yes drops from 43% down to 23%, which is a significant difference. So we've done all the sort of significance tests. So the counterframe group actually drops in its sort of willingness to say the army was definitely responsible. When we turn to the legal frame group, that percentage jumps to 63%. So we see a negative sort of a dampening down effect of the counterframe group and a kind of ramping up effect of the legal frame group.
So what about when it came to the question of General Montt's culpability, his guilt effect, how people saw that?
The response about Rias Montt was different and fascinating at the same time. Here we're asking about the personal responsibility of a former head of state for genocide. So on the definitely yes and probably yes, it was 25% definitely yes and 62% probably yes. There's a little bit less conviction when it comes to we definitely think he's personally responsible. And part of that is from, well, wasn't it just the army, not the leader? There is an issue around the principal agent distinction. But what's really interesting is that the counterframe and legal frame don't have any effect. So if someone is committed to saying Rias Montt was responsible, it doesn't matter whether you give them the treatment of counterframe or the legal frame, they still think he's responsible. So in that way, that conviction's impervious to a framing effect.
So what did respondents say then when it came to the question of who was best placed to deal with questions of genocide?
Again, really interesting. And what we find is we ask whether it should be an internal matter or a decision for the international community. And so for the control group, they really opted for international community, 60% versus 35% who thought internal matter. And that was sort of replicated across. It was always greater support for international. There's something about, you got an individual, you need international credibility to say this person's definitely guilty. So there was general support for that. But the legal frame, when that group of respondents that had exposure to the legal frame jumps to 87%. So it was, you know, if they really thought genocide was committed and that it fit the definition as provided by international law, then an international matter, it's an international matter, right? The international community must try this person. And I find that result really fascinating.
It really sounds like you actually learned quite a lot about this whole naming and framing question. What would you say are the key takeaways?
We were also a little bit worried that, well, maybe there's something about our international community here and the local community, maybe that skewed some of the results. So we did a further bit of analysis which controlled for things like people's predisposition to humanitarianism, whether they were a UK citizen, gender differences, whether they engaged in a sort of isolationist philosophy, as well as some of their ideological predispositions, none of which really had any sort of effect on the outcome. So the surprise for us, I think, was around this sort of immovability of the Rias Montt question, that once you really decided that Rias Montt was responsible, you were impervious to framing effects. I wasn't as surprised about the framing effects for the army, that it would make sense if you really presented with that second story about we're protecting the interests of the state, well, then maybe the army was just kind of protecting security. And equally, if you lay on that legal frame, that there's a really, you know, strong case for culpability. The one surprise, though, was this idea that legal framing really does have an impact in raising the game, if you will, to the international level. And I think one of the key takeaways for human rights advocates, and this will be happy news for the legal community, that advocacy campaigns using legal frames rather than emotive frames may actually be the best strategy for achieving international recognition or trying to push some of these cases to the international level. So that this is very much a good news story around, well, use the Geneva Conventions, use those quotations, use them creatively, but appeal less to the emotive arguments, perhaps, and more to the legal arguments.
Todd Landman was talking to me, Chris Garrington, about Naming and Framing, Guatemala Genocide and the Trial of Rias Montt, a paper by Todd Landman and Thomas Scotto. In our next podcast, Todd discusses the comparative politics of human rights. This series is produced by Research Podcasts.